There is a cup holder on this very slanted podium, and I said I wasn't going to risk putting this glass of water up here and having it fall off, but I'm going to do it anyway, and I'm going to be very careful. I want to thank all of you for coming out. I know that for some of you, you were aware that I was actually scheduled to have been here with you all some months back in the fall, and was unable to come because of things at home that kept me there, and so I had to cancel. But I promised at the time that I would come back, and I try to live up to my promises. So it is good to be back. It is always good to be anywhere within a 500 square mile radius of New York, in which case I get to see my friends from WBAI, who are very consistent and persistent, and thankfully so, about coming out and recording many of my presentations. I'm grateful for that. And for many of you in the room who I know and have met over the years, and for some who I'm just meeting for the first time. I'm going to jump right into it because there is a lot to say, and I've been off the road for a month. And when you take someone who runs their mouth for a living and you keep them at home for 4 weeks and they're unable to speak about the subjects that motivate them, and they're having a good time, don't get me wrong. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and it was wonderful to be able to spend some uninterrupted time with them. But then when you turn that person loose again, you know, out into the world to pontificate, you can imagine that person has a lot of things to get off his or her chest, and so do I. So I will jump right into it by talking a little bit about the genesis of the book, but more to the point, using that as a jumping off space for the discussion I want to have, or to help us have tonight. Often, since I began doing anti-racism work professionally, and that's been 15 years ago and 11 years now that I've been on the lecture circuit, so-called, strangers who I meet will often ask me, and for those of you who are white and do anti-racism work in some capacity, you have probably had the question asked of you, why is it that you decided to take up that issue? You know, when the subject is raised of racism, what made you take that up? They're not necessarily asking it in order to be critical. They're not necessarily asking it with any kind of negative or pejorative intent. They're just very perplexed. People are just very confused. They then proceed to say, well, did you see a lot of racism growing up? Is that what it was? And of course, particularly since I'm from the South, you know, everybody assumes that that's the only place that one sees racism, and that one sees lots of it there, but nowhere else. And so naturally, when you're speaking with someone, particularly who's not from the South, you know, you must have seen a lot of racism, and that must be why you decided to take up this issue. Well, of course, indeed, I did see a lot, as I would have seen a lot, no matter where I lived in this country and within this culture. But the interesting thing about that question, both the first question, which is, why did you take up this issue? Why is this so important to you? But then the second question, is it because you saw a lot of racism against black folks, Latinos, people of color who you knew? The problem with both of those questions, right, is that they both implicitly assume, and perhaps explicitly assume, that racism is fundamentally and really only a black person's issue, or a Latino issue, or an Asian issue, or an indigenous First Peoples issue. In other words, it would only be an issue for me because it was an issue for someone else and maybe I witnessed it, right? And so I'm sort of vicariously taking it up. The idea being that whites would only care or should only care about it if they have personally seen people of color victimized. But what I want to suggest, if nothing else this evening, and in the course of all of my work, is that indeed, were race and racism not first issues for those of us who were white, they would never have become issues for those who were black and brown. And so we have the causation exactly backwards from where it should be. The question is not, why would a white person take up this issue, but why would a white person not see race and racism as their issue? Now, of course, that is somewhat of a rhetorical question on my part, because I know full well why we don't. Why would we? We are led to believe from the time that we are really quite young, at least, let's say, in high school in this country, to believe and to really view racism as a people of color issue only, as if it has no meaning or relevance to white folks at all. Why are we led to believe this? Well, we're led to believe it based on the literature that nice liberals ask us to read. I'm talking about the nice white liberal teachers in mostly nice white liberal schools who want their white students to understand race, and so they make us read that book, Black Like Me, by John Howard Griffin. Now, it's a fine book. It was written in 1959, published in 1960. by a white journalist who took medication for a few months, became, for a very brief period of time, a black man, traveled throughout the Jim Crow South, spent a significant amount of time, particularly in the New Orleans area, wrote about his experiences, which, as you can imagine, were not particularly positive, and it became an overnight sensation. It is a fantastic book and has been for four decades at getting white folks to go, oh my goodness. Keep in mind, this is not a book that is assigned in too many black schools, because the kids sort of know the drill, and they don't really need to read a book written by a white guy telling them what it means to be black for 3 months because he took drugs. But it's a book that is used for white folks. Now, the irony of this ought to be obvious to you, right? One is that white America was only prepared to hear the truth about black life in this country when it was told to them, not by an actual black person, but by a white person whose whiteness actually gave him credibility as a black man. Real black people had been writing this book for generations. Not with that title, though it would have been more honest and to the point had they used that title, and no one in white America, or very few at least, seemed to care. White man takes Sorlin for 3 months. That's the name of the medication, in case any of us white folks really want to go get a prescription for that. Want to make sure you get the right one, you know. White man writes the book, and white America is amazed. Oh my God, we had no idea. We need to make a movie out of this, you know. And they did. The second and maybe more important irony, though, right, is that assigning that book, as good as it is, allows us to believe that the only way that white America can understand the issue of race or racism is to understand it vicariously through the eyes of the other. And although it is vital that we listen to the words and the wisdom of those who are of color, actual people of color, not white people playing at it for the summer, it is at least as important for us to think about not what it means to be something we're not and can never be, but to be exactly what we are on a regular basis. Because long before we are asked to read John Howard Griffin's version of blackness, we have been living in white face, as I write in the book, for 15, 16, 17, 27 years. And we know a little bit more about race than we let on. So it's fundamentally dishonest and disingenuous to speak of race as if it were only or even mostly a people of color issue, because people of color can't experience otherness alone. They can't experience otherness in isolation. By definition, if one is called or looked at or perceived as the other, one must have a reference point for that norm against which one is being compared or made into the other. In other words, if blackness means something, if brownness means something, whiteness must, by definition, mean something too. But we're not encouraged to engage that question, perhaps because it is too close to home, perhaps because it is too demanding of our time and attention, perhaps, and more to the point, because it takes away our innocence and our ability to abstract this issue as someone else's problem that we can deal with perhaps on Monday, but not so much on Wednesday. And then we can take it up again on Thursday, but not so much on Friday, because if we see it as something that we are living on a regular basis, then it becomes something we must address on a regular basis, and that is frightening to us. So we use language, you know, that obscures the role of whiteness, the problem of whiteness, that obscures that whiteness has any meaning at all. What kind of words do we use? What am I speaking of here? Well, think just for a second, and you can probably think of other examples. I mentioned a few of these in the book, and I've mentioned them in many of my talks elsewhere. We have these terms that we use for the other, you know, for those who are different, for those who are lesser than, quote unquote, particularly in terms of race and class status, particularly when the two are combined. So what is the term we use, you know, for the people on the bottom of the political, social, and economic hierarchies? And by the way, here I do not mean the term used by reactionaries. We know what terms they use. There's no point in belaboring those terms. I'm talking about the terms that nice liberals use. The terms that service providers use. Good, caring people who just want to help, right? People who work for charitable organizations and people who are social workers and teachers, all lovely human beings to a person. What's the term they use with no ill intent, but I would suggest with quite ill effect? The term is underprivileged. Now, this is a fascinating term. It is fascinating for at least two reasons. Number one, it is the passive voice. I remember at least that much from my English classes. It is passive. It doesn't imply that anybody did anything to anyone. It's just, here's privilege and I'll be damned. There you are under it. And we haven't any idea how you got there, nor do we have any interest in finding out. So hush, let's move on to another subject. The other problem with the term, perhaps even bigger than that one, is that it's not just passive and thereby obscures the active component of oppression, that it's not a coincidence, you know, that someone is down here, but it also ignores the relative nature of the term. The term is relative by definition. This is not ideology. This is not philosophy. One doesn't have to agree with anything I say politically. This is inarguable. It is third grade grammar. If I say something is under, by definition, it is under relative to that which is over. You cannot have an under without an over, and yet we do not use the term overprivileged in polite conversation. But there must be such people. Who are they? I don't know. I don't want to know. Right? So much so that if you have a computer, and if you are like most people running Microsoft Word, whether by choice or by force, I would challenge you to go home. Before you go to bed tonight, get on Microsoft Word, and I want you to do two things. I want you to first type in the word underprivileged, and rest assured, your spell checker will recognize that word. It is in the dictionary. All right. And then I want you to come down one line below, and I want you to type in the term overprivileged, and I want you to watch how fast that little red line pops up. That line that says, we have no idea what in the hell you are talking about. Because Microsoft, and note the irony here, please, does not understand the concept of overprivilege. And if Microsoft does not understand what it is to be overprivileged, then it ought not shock any of us that the rest of us, you know, in polite society miss it as well. We use terms like underclass. We know exactly who is being referred to. We do not use the term overclass in polite conversation, though again, by definition, there must be one. We use the term minority, and this is problematic in a number of ways. Now, some of these you all have talked about probably in the past, that to call people of color minorities in a global system in which, of course, whites are actually the minority is itself inferiorizing and inaccurate. But putting that aside, we just simply don't use the term majority as the flip side to label those who were white in this country. So even to the extent we use minority, as flawed as that is, why don't we don't ask white people, what's it like, what are the problems in the majority culture? We don't use that term. We don't call majorities majorities. You know, I thought for a while about writing a book that would be called, something about, my life as a majority. And then I realized nobody would know what the hell that meant. It would just be like, what is that? Because minority can refer to a single person, and we know exactly what it means. Majority's not used in that way. Why? Because we're not only seeking to inferiorize those that we term with that label, we're also seeking to make them the issue, usually for unflattering ways, to even call out the majority, even within a smaller culture, not the globe, which in this country would quantitatively and in terms of power mean white folks, is something that just doesn't comport with our normal everyday use of language. So when we talk about race, we focus on them, quote unquote, usually in an unflattering way. We refer to their organizations as special interest groups, and we blame folks of color for engaging in what we derisively term identity politics, ignoring that there would be no identity politics in which to engage had whites, or rather Europeans, not created and fabricated our own white identity out of disparate European backgrounds for the sake of aggrandizing power, privilege, and opportunity. That is to say, if Europeans don't create identity politics along the lines of race, then we don't have to worry about black and brown folk doing it on their own. Identity politics is created by the dominant group, and then we turn around and blame the non-dominant for responding based on their interest as non-dominant and oppressed and exploited group members, which seems a bit backward. So then what does it mean to be white? If we want to focus some attention on that, and I insist that we do, what does it mean? Well, on the one hand, it's what I've already said. It is the ability to focus on everyone but you. That's part of what it means to be white. It's the ability to set up the frame within which all conversation about race will transpire. It is the ability to not only have your perspective heard, which goes without saying, but to make sure that your perspective will become the perspective, the ability, as Malefi Asante says, to universalize the particular, to take that which is specific to you and make it stand in for the normal, natural, everyday, everybody human experience. It is something which, if we have to create a word for it, we could call perspectivism. The ability to make your perspective, combine it with power, and make it stick for everyone. Can't remember who said it first. It was either Wade Nobles or the folks at the People's Institute, but either way, it's quite a brilliant comment posed in the form of a question. The question, it's almost like a riddle, is when we all sit down together and gather around the multicultural table, what do white people bring? And the answer, of course, is the table. So that's what it means. And I could spend a lot of my time and a lot of yours addressing specifically the various privileges, the very advantages, the various immunities, if you will, that extend to people on the basis of whiteness. But my book addresses that. All of my other writings address that. And so I'm not going to belabor that point here. Instead, I want to go in a slightly different direction rather than simply ticking off a litany of privileges that I think and I hope are understood, though I'm willing to discuss them in the Q&A. Instead, I want to talk about what whiteness means through the lens of a particular phrase, a particular statement about whiteness made by James Baldwin in Ebony Magazine in 1965. And it is, to me, perhaps the most brilliant single comment about whiteness made by anyone, including Baldwin, who made several such brilliant comments during the course of his life and his career as a writer. And here is what he said. He said, "These innocent people," and he was using the term innocent in the only most ironic sense of the term, you know, with sort of tongue planted firmly in cheek. He said, "These innocent people are trapped in a history they do not understand, and until they understand it, they cannot be released from it." Now, that comment to me is both brilliant at first blush and also sort of inherently counterintuitive. How can one be both brilliant and counterintuitive? Very easy. Of course, Baldwin wasn't really being counterintuitive. He's trying to make a deeper point. But I know that when people hear the comment, once I told somebody that quote and they said, well, that's counterintuitive. Because after all, how can you be trapped when you're the top dog? How can you be trapped in anything when you've got the advantage and you've got the power and you've got the privilege? Isn't Baldwin sort of over-assuming the degree to which white folks are actually trapped? And then the person said, well, in addition, it's counterintuitive because for Baldwin to say, until they understand it, they can't be released from it, assumes they want to be released from it. And why in the world would they want that? But Baldwin, of course, is not one to spout nonsense in the course of his writing. He knew about what he was speaking. He was trying to imply, as very few people did during the time that Baldwin wrote about these subjects. He was one of few to engage this issue and to insist that indeed there was something happening to white people. There was something that had happened to us and that was continuing to happen to us that was damaging, that was destructive. It was obviously destructive to him as a black man. It was destructive to all persons of color, but he insisted that it was also destructive to whites. In today's terminology, we might call that collateral damage, in the sense that whites are certainly not the intended victims of a system of racism and subordination and racial domination that we have in this country. But just because we are not the intended victims does not mean that we cannot be damaged by it anyway. And so the question I want to engage, and I engage it some in the book, I want to engage it more tonight, is why would privileged people, dominant group members, want to be released from this trap? And what is this trap anyway? After all, these are important questions to ask and to answer, because our culture obviously does not encourage privileged people to give away their edge, right? So it does seem counterintuitive. Why would you do that? Why would you want to give up something that places you above others in a hyper-competitive society where being above others is part of the point of the society, right? After all, our parents, when we're young, they tell us things like, count your blessings. They don't then proceed to follow that up with, and then give them all away. You know, they just want you to count them so you know how many you have. And back in the day, several of you will remember this. It was not something as common in my generation, which is to say people born, let's say, from about the mid-60s on, but from what I understand from parents, it was used to be very common for parents to tell their kids, eat all your vegetables, you know, their children starving in China or wherever there was something going on, Biafra, whatever, something bad. Eat all your vegetables. There are also children starving in the U.S., so, you know, eat your vegetables, which is really sort of an invitation to gluttony, right? Because obviously, you know, they're not saying there are people starving in China, box up your food and send it there. They're basically saying, there are people starving, yeah, they're dying. They have no food. Here, would you like seconds? Would you like thirds? You see, so we're not giving away our edge. We're encouraged to keep it and to bank it and to take more advantage of it. So then in a culture like that, you know, how do you get people to want to change? Well, I think the only way is, of course, to demonstrate this thing Baldwin was trying to get at, which is the way in which the dominant group is damaged, even as we receive huge relative benefits. And I want to suggest that there are three ways, three levels at which whites are damaged. We are, again, collateral damage, and I do not want to equate this to the damage done to people of color by a system of white supremacy. They are not the same. They are not equivalent. But these are the damages that we as whites had best take quite seriously if we want to understand not only what it means to be white on the upside, but what we pay for the receipt of those privileges, because I want to suggest that the cost is rather enormous, and that indeed there are some real reasons beyond the moral, beyond the ethical, beyond the merely altruistic, which again are not things that are encouraged in this culture. Altruism for the sake of altruism, doing the right thing because it's the right thing, is not something which has a lot of cultural resonance in this society. But I want to suggest that there is some real self-preservation and some self-interest in creating a more equitable and just society. The three levels at which whites are damaged, the costs are paid in the following terms: mental and emotional terms, political and economic terms, and then also in terms of the loss of personal integrity. These things may sound ephemeral and somewhat abstract to you. I will try to make them more solid. On a mental and emotional level, it is simply a truism, that is to say, something so true it cannot be argued intelligibly, right? That to be white in this time, if not other times, but certainly in this time, is to almost by definition not understand the world around you. It is to live in a fantasy world of your own creation that bears almost no resemblance to the truth. This is true not only with regard to our inability seemingly to perceive racism as an ongoing reality, but a lot of other things as well. First, let's talk about the issue of race itself. What other than a removal from the real world could possibly lead white America to believe as it does? And this does not mean, when I say white America, see, there's this thing, white folks are not, we're not used to this. This is called race talk. Black and brown folk do race talk and they understand the language. When you say white America, you don't mean every single solitary white person in the joint. You mean white people as a corporate entity, this larger structure. So not calling individuals out, not saying bad things about individual human beings, flesh and blood people, talking about this larger structure, that white America as a larger corporate entity, if you will, is very quick to deny the existence of racism in spite of the evidence. What else other than a removal from the real world could explain that? What am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about the poll taken not all that long ago, in the late 90s, where white folks were asked, do you believe that racial discrimination against peoples of color is still a significant national problem? And a whopping 6%, that is to say 6 out of 100, said yes, that it was still a significant national problem. To give you an idea of how pathetic and anemic this response is, I would have you compare it and contrast it to another number gathered in a previous survey of about 2 years prior, in which roughly 12% of white Americans had no compunction at all telling pollsters that we believe there was a fairly decent chance that Elvis Presley might still be alive. For those of you who were not good at calculating probability and statistics, or in this case, just sort of doing simple math, I will tell you what that means. It means, in fairly simple terms, that whites are, what, 2 times as likely to believe that Elvis might still be alive as we are to believe what people of color tell us they experience on a regular basis. Not that they read about it in a book, or that they saw something about it on a PBS special or heard about it on the radio, that they lived it, and yet only 6% of white folks are willing to believe that which we are being told fairly regularly is happening. This kind of denial
on the part of otherwise sane and decent, and I would think fairly intelligent and humane human beings is stunning. And it's intergenerational, it's not new. So for example, in a Gallup poll taken in 2000 and then again in 2004, they do it every 4 years in fact, white Americans were asked the question in a slightly different way. The question was, do you believe that people of color are treated equally in your community in regard to housing, education, and within the criminal justice system and policing? So it wasn't quite the same as the other one about, do you think it's a big problem? But it was still, it was trying to gauge white America's perception. And they also asked the question of black and brown folk, right? So white folks get asked this question, and between 70 and 80% of white Americans, depending on which category, housing, education, or criminal justice was being asked about, 70 to 80% of white folks said, oh yes, absolutely. People of color are treated fully equally in our community. Of course, you ask black and brown folk the very same question in those very same communities, they had a slightly different take, right? But you should know that that denial is not just the luxury of 40 years after the Civil Rights Act. It's not simply that white Americans have fallen into this kind of la-la land because after all, we passed all these laws, and so you can sort of excuse that ignorance because naturally things have gotten so much better. Oh, no, no. This is very much the exact same answer that was given by white Americans in 1962 when the same question was put to them by the Gallup organization. Because see, these pollsters, they got this funny little habit. They ask the same question year after year because that's how they get what social scientists call longitudinal validity, right? They can't make decisions about how views have changed if they ask the question differently. So they ask the same question in 1962, and what do you know, between 70 and 80% of white Americans then, prior to the Civil Rights Act, prior to the Voting Rights Act, 6 years before the Fair Housing Act, only 8 years after Brown v. Board, but long before any schools had moved with all deliberate speed, which was neither deliberate nor speedy, to do anything about school inequity, white folks were convinced that everything was fine. And this, of course, is a remove from reality that is the result of privilege. If one has the privilege of never having to know the truth, because one doesn't have to live around those who know it and live it, one has the ability to move where one wants, when one wants. One doesn't have to educate one's children around those who know it and live it. One has the ability and the freedom and the mobility and the privilege of going where one wants, when one wants. When those things are true, then it becomes very easy to live in that ignorance. What I want to suggest is that that ignorance is not healthy, that there is a cost to it, not only borne by those who were the victims of it, those who were of color, but even for those who are white. And then white folks get shocked when the truth hits us in the face. White people get shocked about a lot of things. We get shocked and then we get indignant. And there is nothing more dangerous than indignance on the part of people with too much power, right? Especially when we get shocked. We can't believe it. Everything, we're like, I don't know if you ever did this, but when, back when I was really broke, and I'm lucky I'm not really broke anymore, but when I was really broke, I had this habit. And sometimes I still catch myself doing it. When I go to the ATM machine to get money, I wouldn't look at the receipt, right? I didn't want to look at the receipt because I didn't want to know how little money I had. And I thought that, like, if I didn't look, that it wouldn't matter. Like, the money would be more if I just didn't know the truth. And white America is sort of like me with my ATM receipt that I'm not looking at. I don't want to look. But then, you know, what I do from time to time is you put the receipt on the table and you're cleaning up and you pick it up one day and you go, oh my God, I didn't realize I had so little money. That's like white America. We all of a sudden look at the receipt, you know, we look at the slip and we go, oh my God. And then we get really angry for like a minute. So Katrina happens and white folks are shocked. We discover poor black people in New Orleans, where we had no idea there were any. We had no idea there were people suffering, that there were people in poverty, that there were people who didn't have cars or credit cards or checks or extra cash laying around with which they could have left town. And we were stunned. And not just, you know, sort of white America corporately, but very specific representatives. People like David Brooks, columnist for the New York Times, very conservative, right? And boy, he was stunned. He was shocked. He couldn't believe it. He wrote columns for like 4 days. Oh my God, this is terrible. He was just blown away and he wrote this piece. He said, this has shattered our faith in the institutions of our system. Who in the hell is we? Who is our here? Whose faith? You see, the only way you had any faith to shatter is if you were a member of the privileged group. You think black folk in New Orleans were stunned that nobody came for them? Is that shocking? Nobody had come for them 6 months earlier when they were just dealing with police killings and just dealing with poverty and just dealing with crumbling schools. And nobody came 40 years earlier when they took the interstate and drove it through the heart of the black community, as happened in every major city in this country, and uprooted black homes and destroyed black businesses to help white folks get from their suburban homes where only they could live to the cities where they still worked. See, sometimes displacement isn't because of a storm. It's very much not a natural disaster. And some folks know that reality and they live it. And some folks are stunned by it so that when it happens, we just can't believe the system would let people down. This was a system failure. No, it's not. That's only a failure if you think the system was set up to serve poor black folk. And if you think that, you're living on another planet. If, on the other hand, you know that it wasn't set up to serve such people, but if anything, to either destroy them or to neglect their needs altogether, this was a system working exactly as planned. And that's not conspiratorial, that's just functional sociological theory. It was functional to not worry about them at the federal, state, or local level, sink or swim, because that's what our culture is really all about. Economically, politically, and socially. So we really ought not be shocked, but we are. And I gotta tell you, that's not healthy. See, here's why. There's a real point to this, and I'll get to it. But there was a survey taken a few years back where they asked white America to speculate on the various percentages of different groups of people, right? Just to sort of see, like, how in tune are white people with the actual demographics of their country, right? Seemingly easy question. So they asked, and the median answer, that is to say the typical, the midpoint answer, right? The median typical answer given by white Americans was this, that African Americans nationwide now were 32% of the population. The actual number is about 13. That Latinos were 21% of the population. The actual number is 13. That Asian Pacific Americans were 10% of the population. The actual number is about 4. And that as a subset of whites, Jews were 18% of the population, whereas the actual number is about 2.5 to 3%. Now, I just want you to add these things up for a second so you can see what kind of delusion we're talking about. If you think that black, Latino, and Asian folks are 32, 21, and 10, that is 63%. You are saying the typical white American now is saying that roughly 2/3 of their country are people of color. And then those Jews take another 18%. Now we're up to 81%. So only 19% of America are white non-Jewish people. No wonder white America is paranoid. They think that, oh my God, they're already taking over. And yet they keep asking for affirmative action. And they keep demanding, quote unquote, minority scholarships. And now they want reparations. And they're already the majority. Leave us alone. Right? Where do you think this anxiety comes from? Comes from a fundamental ignorance and misperception, and that comes from privilege, because only privileged people have the luxury of not knowing anything about the country they live in. People of color have to learn everything in the world about white folk. If you want to graduate from white-dominated schools, if you want jobs in a white-dominated society, you got to learn how white folks think and what white folks experience and what they want you to experience and what they expect from you. White folk can just live over here, 2/3 of the country are people of color, and nothing happens to us for our ignorance, except that we become highly anxious, we feel like we're outnumbered, and it encourages this paranoia, this idea that they are taking over, that they are coming for what we have, and this paranoia and anxiety are not healthy. They lead to all kinds of dysfunctional and pathological responses and reactions, both at the racial level, at the religious level, at the national level, and all of these things interrelate. This notion that we've got to get them before they get us. Where does this come from? Except privilege, because after all, it's only the privileged who have to sit there and sweat that somebody's coming for their stuff, right? This is why I never quite understood why we were so insistent on saying about America now, about the US, we're number one. Shush, don't say that. Nobody's coming for Sweden. Nobody's coming for Denmark. Nobody's coming for number 2, 3, or 4. When you say you're number one, see, then you set yourself up for this mindset of they're coming for us. The immigrants are coming for what we have. George Kennan, one of the fathers of the Cold War, wrote this memo back in 1950 in Foreign Policy or Foreign Affairs magazine, right? This article, right? Where he talked about the rest of the world, and he was really speaking of these nations of color in combination with the Soviet Union wanting to take what we have. Privileged people are always worried about who's beneath them. So that's why we get concepts like preventative war, What is that except the rationale and the logic of a privileged group of people going to war with somebody so they won't go to war with you, making war to prevent war? It's not only Orwellian, it comes inherently from a position of privilege. We gotta get them. Three strikes laws, we gotta get them. We gotta lock them up before they come for us. War on drugs, we gotta get them before they come for us, you see. This is part of the dysfunctionality of that privileged mindset. It leads to this constant anxiety, this constant stress. So do I really have to explain to you the meaning behind the headline in the newspaper's AP story in June of 2004, referencing a study that had just been or was about to be published in the Journal of the American Medical Association? And that article had the following title: United States posts highest rate of mental illness. No kidding. I wonder what that might be about. Now, I read the study. Not only the article about the study, but the study in JAMA, and it was interesting. This was a national level study done with nations all around the world. And what they found, and they were not looking at organic disorders, by the way. This wasn't things like schizophrenia, bipolar, et cetera, because there's not really any reason with things that are really rooted in brain chemistry and organic to think that there would be a substantial difference around the globe. So they weren't looking at those. They were looking at anxiety disorders, depression, and substance abuse disorders. Now, this is interesting. They found that 26% of all persons in the United States, and if you know the way these samples are done, they almost always oversample whites, okay, almost always oversample the dominant group, that 26% of people in the U.S. were suffering from some type of a medically recognized DSM-4, as flawed as the criteria may be, nonetheless, using existing criteria, suffering from some form of an anxiety, depression, or substance abuse mental disorder. That was double the global average. It was five times the percentage in Nigeria, where only 5% of Nigerians suffered from any of these disorders. By the way, this study was not done by the pharmaceuticals in the hope of selling more drugs, so it can't, you know, that would obviously make it very flawed. But it was done by scientists with no particular connection to the pharmaceuticals. They were using the same criteria and finding this huge disproportion of people with mental illness in the United States. Now, why is that? Because think about it. I would imagine that folks in Nigeria, who have lived through all kinds of both economic, political, and social dislocations and stresses, are certainly dealing with more absolute stress, I would imagine, than those of us in the wealthiest, most powerful nation on earth. And yet, they seem to affect far less mental disorder and disease than those of us in this powerful and amazingly privileged space. What might explain that? Well, it can't be proven, but I would certainly argue that at least in part, being privileged, being dominant, being the hegemon within the global order is exactly what encourages that level of anxiety-related disorders. Never feeling like you have enough. Never feeling like what you have is safe. People who are not in the dominant position have other concerns related to survival, not necessarily hoarding what they have because they don't have. But those who have, and particularly those who have a lot, and particularly when they know, be it conscious or subconscious, that those things they have didn't all come about because of superior morals, superior ethics, or superior genetics, that indeed they came about because of some forms or many forms of injustice, it encourages that kind of paranoia. You see, when you're the king of the hill, whether it's racial, national, religious, or anything else, any rise at all from those below you, any improvement in the situation of those below, any challenge to your hegemony and your dominance, even if your dominance is still largely intact, is seen as a huge threat, and it is magnified manyfold. So in other words, to be members of the dominant group, whether we're talking in racial terms, whether we're talking in national terms, or especially a combination of those two things, can be highly stressful and anxiety-producing in a way that's unhealthy. That is to say that equity might actually be a much healthier place from which to organize a society. To not have that is to constantly be on edge in a way that isn't healthy, and then when something happens, you're not prepared. So 9/11 happens. And I know that anyone, white, black, or otherwise in this country, on September 11th was afraid, they were shocked, they were stunned, well, not really shocked or stunned, but afraid and upset and even perhaps angry. But it was interesting, was it not, that in the week or so after 9/11, when I was watching media pretty much around the clock, looking and seeing what people were saying, that the only people who said, "Why do they hate us?" were white. I didn't see any people of color asking that question. Not to say that none thought it or wondered it, but the only people who seemed to be walking around in a total daze totally unhinged. Why do they hate us? I don't understand. We're white. Now, not every white person said it, but only in my experience did white people say it. You see, only the privileged have the luxury of not knowing the answer to that question. Only the privileged have the luxury of never asking it, of never having had to contemplate it. Others, of course, know what it is like to be hunted and hated and terrorized. The only thing new to people of color about September 11th was that for the first